Ladies and gentlemen, this is the 12th and final round.
Right hand, Golovkin steps in and down he goes again. Unbelievable. Mayweather makes him pay. What a rookie mistake. A sensational left hook by De La Hoya.
It's facts. I'm the best. You know what I mean? Sometimes I don't want to believe it myself, but it's the truth. I'm the best.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
From Southern California, this is the Last Round Podcast.
Welcome back to episode 125 of the Last Round Podcast. Wherever you're at, however you're listening, we appreciate it. Whether you're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Boxing Socials, YouTube channel, our new India's mobile application, GeoSavin. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. I apologize if I'm not, to our listeners in the country of India, but that's becoming a very popular app on our statistics behind the scenes here at the Last Round. But this week, jumping right into it, this week we welcome play-by-play announcer, commentator for Triller Fight Club, for Major League Wrestling, also known as MLW, and the host. You may see him, especially boxing fans, you may see him on the Premier Boxing Champions cards on Showtime, Fox. You know, he's always at the press conferences, the post-fight press conferences. He's all over the PBC banner most of the time. And I think he's also done some work on DAZN and some other boxing promotions. He's been all over. If you're a boxing fan, you've definitely seen him on your television screen. Ray Flores joins us this week on the Last Round. Thanks a lot for joining us, Ray.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine, Mike and Danny. It's honestly, congratulations on all your success, and couldn't be happier for you guys.
We definitely appreciate that. Something coming like that from you, we definitely appreciate that, Ray. But you know, we've been meaning to get you on for quite a while. Mm-hmm. You know, people love, obviously we're a boxing podcast. People love when we get fighters and coaches, trainers and stuff like that. But we always get direct messages and requests and tweets and stuff like that about getting other people around the sport, like commentators, play-by-play hosts, announcers and stuff like that. Or even like, you know, people behind the scenes in marketing and stuff like that. People want to know about the other aspects in the sport of boxing. Mm-hmm. And people have been messaging us. We've got maybe more than, a handful, maybe 10 or more messages in maybe the last year about you coming on the show, like, hey, you guys should get Flores on. And so we've been meaning to get you on. So we're glad that we finally got in contact with you and you had some time to jump on. We definitely appreciate that.
Yeah, it's the perfect week, guys. I mean, honestly, you couldn't ask. I mean, from my standpoint, it's the perfect week. And, you know, glad to be with you guys. A lot going on. Pumped to dive into so many different things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So let's just start before we kind of jump into some boxing questions about the sport and, you know, what you think about certain fighters and, you know, potential matchups or any actual confirmed matchups coming up. Let's talk about you for a little bit and your career, how you got into this entertainment and sports and entertainment realm of this world. Did you always want to become an announcer, or what drew you to this type of career?
Yeah, well, I learned early on in my life that I was so, influenced, inspired by when I grew up. So I grew up, I'm a kid of 86. So I grew up watching a lot of great broadcasters. Like my earliest memories of like watching boxing was listening to Jim Lampley and Steve Albert, because Lampley was HBO, Albert was Showtime. And I thought they both did an unbelievable job. I mean, obviously being from the Chicagoland area, Michael Jordan was king. So we grew up watching the Bulls on NBC with Marv Albert and, you know, those, you know, Bob Costas as the host. So I grew up watching the greats. I mean, I also grew up being a pro wrestling kid, late 80s. So listening to Gorilla Monsoon and Vince McMahon and, Jim Ross and those guys. So I was influenced from a variety of different angles when it comes to amazing sportscasters. And early on in my life, I knew I didn't have, a lot of athletic ability. So I was like, I asked my dad, I'm like, how do I make a career out of this? And he's like, well, how about sportscasting? I was like 5-6 years old. I was always an inquisitive kid. And then that's when my mind started saying, like, all right, I can't jump high, even at that age, right? But I wanted to do something that involved sports. So I started paying attention to a lot of that stuff. I started doing local access TV in my hometown of East Chicago, Indiana. So for old school boxing fans, if you remember the name Angel Man Freddy. So Angel Man Freddy, a guy who beat the late great Arturo Gatti, you know, he was a contender at, I think, like 35 and 40 back in the 90s, fought on HBO boxing several times, lost to Floyd Mayweather by second round knockout and stuff. So he was, you know, in some marquee fights for himself. But I grew up in the same city doing local access TV, ran into an MMA fighter named Miguel Torres. We did a piece on him. The Ultimate Fighter happened, and he was in the corner of Stephen Bonner. Stephen Bonner fought Forrest Griffin, that epic battle. So I called him up. I'm like, hey, I'm like, are you still fighting locally? He said, absolutely. So I started following him around at his fights. We would film his fights and then show him a week later on public access TV to not affect the promoter getting the gates and stuff. So then that leads me to go into school in Chicago at Columbia College. MMA boxing radio show that, you know, the school gave me because I was always talking about fighting. And then I meet one promoter, leads to the other. And then it just kind of built from there. And, you know, I've been involved in the fight business since I was 18. So I'm 34 now. It's about 16 years of my life that I've been involved in this business.
Do you recall, because you touched on a few different aspects of announcing and commentating, such as, you know, pro wrestling, boxing, different avenues like that. Is there one moment in time in terms of announcing, whether it's professional wrestling or boxing, that as you were growing up, that stands out on your mind? You're like, oh, I'm always going to remember that call.
Like moments wise. For me, it wasn't necessarily a call, but it was more so in events. So the big event that I really remember, I was such a boxing nerd. I mean, I still am. Like, I was so into it and just the business of sportscast. And I remember watching Chavez Camacho, like the countdown show an hour before the show. So like listening and watching Jim Hill and what they were doing on the pay-per-view, and then watching Steve Albert and the presentation of that, you know, with the fight doctor, Ferdy Pacheco, and everything. So I remember that whole broadcast from start to finish. I work with Joe Goosen now on FS1 telecast. I remember watching Chavez Halgan, 132,000 people. The first fight on the pay-per-view was Azuma Nelson defending his championship against Gabriel Ruelas. Joe Goosen was his trainer. So it just goes, and I was like 6 years old watching this, but it's just crazy at how life comes full circle for you if you keep along the path that you feel like you're destined to be on.
In terms of, your career as you were beginning, when did you really receive your first big break in the business?
I've been really fortunate, guys, because I've gotten a lot of breaks over the course of my time. So I started off, I'll be honest with you, without the Chicagoland, Northwest Indiana boxing and MMA scene, I wouldn't be where I am today. So that's one part of my career, and I will always forever be grateful. The next part was when I was, I used to go over to England to work for a promoter in England calling MMA fights, and I was the ring announcer, play-by-play man. But this guy bought my ticket, you know, took care of my hotel, picked me up at the airport. We were doing like the Active Channel, like like Sky 4 or something like that, like, you know, that stuff. So that's another big part of my career. Here in the States, though, was filling in for Joe Martinez for Golden Boy in December of 2011. So Joe came to Chicago, did an MMA show, liked my work, him and I worked together. And he goes, hey, you know, do you want to fill in for me? Golden Boy, we're like, yeah, we'll audition him. This is December of 2011. After that, because Joe was busy with the UFC, WEC, stuff like that, I did about 10 solo book sales shows for Golden Boy. Then in 2013, I got with Artie Pullullo of Banner Promotions. And Artie was doing fights on ESPN Friday Night Fights. I did Friday Night Fights with Artie, 13, 14, and most of 15. But it's because of Artie that I made my HBO boxing debut. I talk about things coming full circle. Here I am, 4 or 5 years old, watching Jim Lampley, Provodnikov, Matisse, my HBO debut. Buffer is in Dallas doing Crawford Delorme. Kellerman's there with someone else. And Lampley was up with Bernard Hopkins. And I was the ring announcer of Provodnikov, Matisse at Turning Stone in upstate New York. December of 14, I was doing undercards of Mayweather Maidana in 2014. This is like May or September. I forgot which fight it was. Someone comes up to me and they go, hey, they go, you know, can I have your contact information? Tom Brown's wife, Sandy Goosen Brown, and you know, Tom Brown, president of TGP Promotions. Tom Brown's wife walked into the MGM, somehow heard me ring announcing undercards, because I was doing ring announcing of Mayweather undercards off TV, and was like, you need to go ahead and like, you need to bring that guy into the company. So they got a hold of me, and I did my first show with them on ESPN. Like, it was a special edition of Friday Night Fights in December of 14. Tom asked me after the show, he goes, what are you doing next week? I'm like, well, you know what, you know, I'm available. He goes, all right. He goes, I'll see you in, you know, Seattle next week. You're doing Showbox. He called that PBC started March of 15. Tom called me in June of 15 to start doing pressers. I got hired by PBC in July of 15 to start working ESPN fights, NBCSN, and all the FS1 shows. So, I mean, that's my career in a nutshell, guys.
Oh, go ahead, Mike.
Ray, what would you say is the biggest like misconception of the job that you do? Because I'm sure a lot of people just think that you just look at the card and you just read off the next fight and that's it.
Yeah, they think it's easy. And the thing is that, look, what I'm doing is not like curing cancer, or I'm not a public servant, right? But when it comes to my job, especially on a play-by-play standpoint, anything I do, it's all about preparation. So you might see us on the air for about 3 hours, 2-3 hours, however long the show might be. But you didn't realize that, at least from my standpoint, I prepared for 25 to 30 hours for those 2 to 3 hours that I'm on the air, because I want to know these guys inside out. I want to listen to their interviews. I want to make my own conclusions. I watch tape because you, the viewers, deserve that kind of preparation from us, the commentators. This is how I earn my living. And this is what I love more than anything. Combat sports is what I love more than anything on this planet. It's what I was born to do. So you guys deserve me being at my absolute, you know, maximum preparation, so I can tell you the best story possible, because you're the one who's tuning in and paying for our salaries and paying for the fighters to be able to earn their living.
Does that preparation include being in front of the mirror and and then doing any of that type of work?
No, nothing like that. Maybe early on in my career, but more so now, it's about me getting in the mindset and being able to kind of figure out in my head, what are the storylines, know these guys inside and out. And then, you know, I also like make sure that, you know, my wardrobe is good and stuff like that. And I have everything that I need in order to be able to excel at my maximum capacity.
Is there, could you say, obviously you mentioned that you study a lot of the fighters' past, you know, what they've come from. So that way you can be more well-rounded in announcing them and describing what they're coming from and stuff like that, like at pressers or anything like that.
Yeah.
Is there like one specific tidbit that stands out in your mind that a fighter maybe told you after, like, hey, I can't believe you knew that, or anything like that?
Yeah. Where some guys will say, you know, they're like, oh man, they're like, how did you know that about me? There've been so many, or not so many, but there've been some, and it's because, especially before COVID, guys, like, I like talking to fighters or trainers and those around fighters, because fighters are in this whole different universe mentally and physically, because they're putting themselves ready to get inside the ring, and they're risking their lives every single time they get inside the ring. So I don't really like to talk to them much unless I feel the vibe from them, if that makes any sense, because they're in that mindset, right? So I don't, you know, I'm like, hey, you know, how are you? And I'm cordial, but I don't want to talk to them, because if they want to talk to me, they'll come up and whatever, but I let them be, because they're getting ready to put everything on the line. But what I do is I talk to the trainers. Hey, how was training camp this way? Or, you know, did he do anything special? Whatever. They know I'm going to keep all that stuff confidential because I'm using it for the broadcast. But a lot of times I get more in my personal one-on-one interactions instead of being like, okay, guys, here's a fighter meeting, you know, ask whatever you want, because people get shy in that regard. So if I can talk to a fighter or trainer on the side, I do that, and they know that I'm not going to give away any information until it's time for us to hit the air.
Is there any fighter, since you have several conversations, or, you know, you're around the fighting game, obviously, quite a bit, and you sometimes speak to them in addition to the fighter meeting, you know, maybe one-on-one in passing, you know, might be small talk here and there.
Yeah.
Is there any fighter, or maybe any non-commentator or announcer in the boxing business who has told you, like, hey man, you know, I wanted to be an announcer at one point. I mean, you know, I kind of wanted to do what you did, but I never went that route.
Yeah. Especially when PBC on FS1, the new deal got going. And I mean, I had a lot of different partners on the air, And they would, like, a lot of times it'd be like one of the first few times. So they're like, man, they're like, you know, we didn't know how extensive this was or whatever. Like, you know, Dominic Brazil was very talented, you know, really like Dominic. He's a wonderful person. He's like, man, he's like, you know, I knew I had to like bring my A game, but I didn't know how extensive this was. And I've had people that they don't realize how much traffic it is. Like we're conducting traffic on the air, getting from one element to the other, and how focused we get when we hit the air. I mean, it's literally like a laser focus because I'm just so locked in with my producer. I'm locked in on the fights. I'm locked in with my partner. There's a lot of different things going on that I have to handle and manage. But you know what? I love it. I thrive on it. And it makes me who I am as a person.
There's some fighters, and not just fighters, but athletes in general, who make a pretty smooth transition post-retirement from their sport into the commentating desk. Since, you know, this is your profession, you obviously have a better eye than most. Is there anybody out there in the boxing world or maybe even MMA world or in addition professional wrestling that maybe you could see based on your interactions or from what you've seen over the years that you could see make that transition smoothly, maybe post-retirement?
So guys that aren't in the business already or guys that are fighting right now that might be able to make that transition?
Let's do guys that are fighting right now, and then we'll do guys that aren't in the business already.
Okay. You know who I like, I worked with him one time, and this is when he was like 21 years old. David Benavidez is a guy who's pretty in-depth and detail-orientated with things. You know, he can watch something and really be like, he needs to pop his jab more. He's very, he has good instincts, if that makes any sense. You know, like a lot of times, sometimes I'll like talk in broadcast terms, but it's like, as you guys know, but it's like he has good instincts and he knows like, okay, he needs to do this. And he did a really good job of getting in and out of that. So that's the guy that comes to mind. I mean, a guy who I think would be unbelievable in commentary, but he makes way too much money on the MMA realm is Conor McGregor, because Conor is very philosophical and visualizes, and he can pick up on things very quickly. Like I've seen a lot of interviews that he's done, and he's so into the sport of MMA and understanding the small details. And for us as play-by-play men, it's up to, I like to tee it up to my analysts so they can provide you, the audience, with those small details. Like tell us, you've been in there, you see, you know, you've been at the highest level. Why is this happening or what could potentially happen? So I think to me, those are the two guys that Benavidez and Conor McGregor that I think would make a wonderful transition to commentary.
Ray, have you ever had, you know, fighters fall out with you because of the way that you've called a fight? They thought you were like overly harsh on their performance.
I mean, I wouldn't say that I've had falling outs because I'm pretty, it doesn't make any good for me to rag on a fighter, which I don't, but I also have to call it objectively down the middle. What I'll tell you, Mike, is that I have been stopped in elevators and stuff and be like, hey, you know, why did you think I lost this? Or why did you think this? And, you know, me being the person that I am, maybe it's because I grew up in East Chicago, Indiana. It was like, I'm like, I'll sit and I'm like, hey, well, you know, tell me what did you have a problem with? I answer and I fess up to everything that I say. I'm not one of those guys that is going to say something crazy or whatever and then run away or not see these people. It's like, if I'm saying something on the air, I realize that over the course of my travels, you may not agree with what I'm going to say, but I will stand and we can talk and you can tell me, why did you say this? And I'll tell you, I said this because of A, B, C, D. If I'm going to say it, I'm willing to stand behind it. And if you have concerns, then talk to me about it, because it doesn't do us any good for us. Number one, I hold nothing against any fighters. I respect them all because they got more stones than what I ever will in my life. And I'm being brutally honest with you. But if I'm going to criticize them or be a bit unfair, sometimes we're not always right. Tell me and I'll fess up to it.
And Ray, what's your opinion on, because this always does the rounds on Twitter every few months, but what's your opinion on when people say that, you know, someone like yourself, like you can't have an opinion because you haven't boxed?
I think that it's ludicrous to me, because if you look at every other professional sport, you have baseball writers who didn't play in Major League Baseball, NFL writers who didn't play in the NFL. Do people not realize how important or how special it is to make it to that extremely high level. Like even as an amateur, to excel at a high amateur level, it takes such an amount of skill and sacrifice and determination and athletic ability. Not everybody is meant to play in professional sports, and I'm one of them, but I've been around it enough and have had hundreds upon thousands of hours with conversations, and I've called hundreds of fights all over the world, guys. Knock on wood, been very fortunate and blessed that I can make a determination based on what I'm seeing because I've been educated by some amazing people and legends in the business.
You touched on Conor McGregor a couple minutes ago, Ray. You were involved in the Mayweather-McGregor gigantic event in 2017. How was that, you know, being in front of those two types of personalities, especially at that moment in time with all the attention, all the eyeballs that were tuned in to not just the fight, but, you know, the pressers themselves got millions and millions of views.
It was probably up to this point thus far was the greatest moment of my career because of the fact that you have the two biggest personalities that boxing and MMA have ever seen, the two highest prize fighters by far in their respective sports, Floyd in boxing, Conor in MMA. And you have these larger than life personalities. It's like, it was like the perfect storm that came together. And when I got on the tour, they told me I'm official, I'm locked in. I was like, okay, this is going to be unbelievable. And every city we went to, LA, Toronto, Brooklyn, London, they were all rocking. I mean, you know, they always say about what it was like to tour with the Beatles or being a Chicago kid again, you know, what it meant like to travel with Michael Jordan and the 96 Bulls. I got a small taste of that traveling with those guys, Mayweather and McGregor, in just every city. The energy was off the charts and the passion from the fight fans. And not only that, but watching their work ethic. Here are two guys who had hundreds of millions of dollars in the bank, and yet they work harder than anybody that I've ever seen in my life when it comes to promoting their event. And the fight itself would have sold 3 million pay-per-view buys, but their hustle and their work ethic, every city that we went to, this was a 96-hour grind, guys, mind you. It was nonstop, literally Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and they didn't stop. That's why they drew the second highest amount of pay-per-views, because of how hard they worked. It was their names, yes, but they worked hard. Floyd even had to tell us a couple of the PR people, hey, like if they answer questions, they're like, all right, one more. He's like, no, I'll take another four or five. Conor the same way. These guys hustle even at their level.
Would you say, and probably not, but would you say, you said that was probably the biggest moment in your career up until this point. Prior to that, to those moments, at least, because there was always multiple moments in those events.
Yeah.
When did you, maybe what was the closest feeling that you got before that fight in terms of an event? Like, what's the closest you came to feeling to something like that?
Well, it was for me personally was doing Provodnikov Matisse. So, I mean, on HBO Boxing After Dark. And this was at Turning Stone, where I grew up at Turning Stone in this sense. I was, my first three or four Friday night fight shows was at Turning Stone in Verona, New York. So that place is very near and dear to my heart because that's where I grew up. You know, when Joe Tessitore, and I was working with Tessitore and Teddy Atlas and Bernardo Osuna, guys that are unbelievable and so talented at what they do and marketing names and have been in this sport for a long time. So that's where I grew up on TV in many aspects at Turning Stone. To be able to work an HBO show, the place was sold out, was rocking the styles of the fights. Provodnikov comes straight forward. Matisse comes straight forward. Having Jim Lampley, the guy that I look up to most to anything in this business, throw it up to me in the ring. Like that was the moment where it was like, man, this is unbelievable. And here I am being a young kid. And now he's throwing it to me inside the ring. Like it was nuts.
You know, Jim, you mentioned Jim Lampley. He's obviously legendary in not just the sport of boxing, especially in the sport of boxing, but in all of, announcing, commentating, and combat sports in general. He's obviously been out of the game for a couple years because of HBO's, exit from the boxing business within the last couple of years. But a lot of fans have been expecting him to come back. Then the pandemic hit, so that kind of put a halt on things. So, you know, there's kind of been rumors here and there. He's kind of said something in interviews that he's still interested. Yeah. Would you like to see him come back? And if yes, where do you think he fits in best?
I think if Jim wants to come back, then, you know, he should come back. If he doesn't, then, you know, he has created his own. He's created a legendary career. I think that Jim Lampley, without a doubt, hands down, will go down as the greatest play-by-play man in the history of combat sports, and that's boxing and MMA, hands down. So I look at it two ways. One, if he comes back, hey, it's great to see Jim back doing his thing, et cetera, et cetera. But the way I look at it a little bit on my standpoint, if he doesn't want to come back, guess what? Guys like me, the younger generation, I feel like I am a direct descendant underneath his way of thinking and his preparation, the passion that he had on the air, his moments that he called that were so vivid. It's up to guys like me to continue what he did for us, because he set forth this amazing foundation and he paved the way for us. The same way another guy who I comment on quite a bit, Bernardo Osunam, he paved the way for us too. I'm Hispanic. He paved the way for young guys like me. So Lampley and Bernardo Osunam are guys that paved the way for me. So if Lampley doesn't want to come back, that's okay, because I am willing to take that kind of the professionalism, the attention to detail, the passion and everything, and sort of follow in his footsteps. I'll never be even close to that, even one half of that. But the way that he approached the sport is how I will carry myself throughout the course of my career.
What was your favorite team combination during the HBO years? Because obviously there, Lampley's been the staple in that commentating team, the consistent staple in that commentating team for several years. But he's had some different partners over the years, you know, Manny Stewart, Max Kellerman, Roy Jones, you know, kind of all entered, kind of going back and forth. What was your favorite, you know, I guess, trilogy of commentators during that time?
So guys, I'm such a big, you know, boxing savant that I'll go back on YouTube and try to find old HBO pay-per-view broadcasts from start to finish, because I want to see how it is like. I was watching Oscar De La Hoya, Fernando Vargas last week, the entire show, you know, really seeing how they, you know, just to, you know, pick up on little nuances and stuff. But my favorite team, Jim Lampley. So I would have to say James Brown at the desk, James Brown or Bob Costas at the desk, either or. And then Roy Jones at the desk with James Brown or Bob Costas. Then in the commentary team, you got Jim Lampley, Larry Merchant, his ability to relate and give a historical significance. And then Emmanuel Stewart, who I think is one of the greatest trainers, if not the greatest trainer of all time. So Manny, Larry, and Jim on the commentary for HBO.
Is there a, this is a question that I got from somebody earlier today when we, I told them that you were coming on. Is there a specific moment? And like for me, my example is a specific moment during, especially, you know, going back to HBO boxing. There's a specific moment when the fighters come together face-to-face in the ring, the referee gives his instructions, where the commentating team just stays quiet for like, you know, a minute or two while that goes on. And then the fighters go to their respective corners, and then they still stay quiet until that bell rings, and then they jump in. For me, that's something that I've always appreciated, because it builds to that moment. Yeah. Is there certain little minor details like that that you appreciate and stuff like that?
100%. So for me, and I'm going to pull back the curtain on you guys a little bit, is that when a knockout happens, then unless it's quick, to where it takes me a little, like another second to be able to react. When a knockout happens or knockdown happens, you won't hear me. Why? Because you need to hear what the referee is telling the fighter. And you need to hear if the doctor jumps in, if the corner jumps in. How are you going to understand that and hear that if I'm talking over the moment? So I let the moment be, and then I will make my determination on if I should jump in or if my analyst jumps in. That's how we go ahead. But when a knockdown happens, that's when I lay out. And that's my moment that I am very cognizant of and stuff like that. But I know exactly what you're discussing, because Larry Merchant on those big fights would always wrap it around in storyline. You know, he'd be like, you know, is this going to be, you know, a battle, or is it going to be a boxing match? You know, like the Spartans did it and whatever, like that's what Larry would do. And as a young kid, I'm like, what is he talking about? As an adult, I appreciate it a lot more.
Is there certain people in the business right now, you know, commentators, you know, especially commentators primarily, that you haven't worked with that you would one day like to work alongside with?
That I would want to work with? Let me see.
Because, I mean, obviously you work with a lot of people up until this point, and you still are.
I'm trying to think of, like, the broadcast themes and stuff like that. You know who I want to work with? Raul Marquez. I want to work with Raul. Like, me doing play-by-play, Raul doing being an analyst. I think Raul Marquez is so smooth, so detail-orientated. He doesn't talk over your head like crazy, you know, boxing knowledge, whatever, but still gives you that old fighter perspective. He breaks it down so well. He's so smooth on the air. I mean, I think Raul is absolutely top quality stuff.
Do you speak Spanish, Ray? Because you mentioned you were Hispanic.
I do speak Spanish, but I don't speak it well enough to, like, you know, go ahead and, like, call fights in Spanish.
Oh, okay. That was going to be my follow-up. If you'd be comfortable to ever call a fight Spanish.
I'll leave that to, you know, guys like Jaime Mota and, you know, the guys that do it at ESPN Deportes and stuff.
Right. Like Bernardo Osuna. He's pretty good. He's pretty solid.
Bernardo and I did a fight together in Puerto Rico in 2013 or 2012, and it was like 100 degrees in there, and I was wearing a tuxedo, and I was like sweating throughout the entire night and stuff like that. So, but Bernardo is unbelievable.
And then, you know, in terms of, I guess the fights that are happening or have happened, you know, and I guess looking forward, is there any of them that you're looking forward to? There's obviously some that have been confirmed or they're likely to fight, you know, or is there any that you'd like to see just as a fan, you know, not even just as a person in the business, but just as a fan?
So, I mean, I'm excited about and I don't mean to sound cliche, but I am excited about all fights. You know why? Because I don't like to judge a fight until after it happens. So some of the greatest moments in our sport have been from quote unquote mismatches on paper. And you're like, oh my gosh, like, how are you going to miss that? So I try to watch everything if I can. Like, I got my DVR and everything else, or highlights on YouTube. I try to watch everything. Fights that I want to see, I want to see Spence Crawford. I think everybody wants to see that. I think that's a foregone conclusion. Also, I want to see Canelo go up there against the likes of Caleb Plant. I want to see him fight a David Benavidez. I want to see him fight a Jermall Charlo. So that's, you know, those are fights that I definitely want to see. You know, another fight that I want to see that I think would be absolutely bananas is Joe Smith Jr. and Artur Beterbiev. Because those guys talk about throwing sledgehammers. Like, I ring announced when Joe Smith was a major underdog in Chicago against Andrew Funfara. He knocked out Funfara in the first round. Funfara was supposed to fight somebody else who escapes me at the moment. Joe Smith was brought in on 3 weeks' notice. And I remember the consensus in the boxing community was like, oh, who's this Joe Smith guy? Or, you know, they, you know, dusted off a club fight or this and that. And it's like, listen, like, I'm like, you know, we'll wait and see. You know, I want to give it benefit of the doubt. And what happens first round, he comes out, blast Funfara like crazy, and then finished him off. And it was like, oh my gosh. And then he kept doing it again. He knocked out Bernard Hopkins out of the ring. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it was Bernard Hopkins' last fight. So, you know, guys like that are moments that have stood out in my career. But yeah, I mean, I want to see Joe Smith and Artur Beterbiev as well. So give me that fight, because it'd be unbelievable.
So you touched on Joe Smith Jr., who's actually, he just fought this past weekend in a majority decision, went over Maxim
Blasov,
yeah, for that. And then this was for the vacant WBO light heavyweight title that Joe Smith now is the holder of. Initially, do you believe this was a controversial decision? Because, you know, if you kind of follow social media, especially boxing Twitter, some people believe it was a little bit controversial.
No, I thought Joe won the fight. I thought he did enough to win it. And, you know, it was, you know, he did enough. And then that, what happened in the ninth round, are you kidding me? Like, I know that Carl Moretti and Pa Barra and Joe DiGuardi were going crazy. Well, I understand why. I mean, because they had every right to be upset with, you know, what happened in the ninth. So, I mean, I thought Joe did enough to win the fight. I don't think it was, I've seen controversial decisions. I've read a lot of controversial decisions. That to me was not controversial. And also the fact that how cool was it? I don't know if you guys saw the video of Joe Smith presenting the title to his longtime trainer. I thought that was so selfless. Like here, Joe had his moment, the moment that he's always craved for. And what did he do in the dressing room? He gave it to his trainer and said it meant the same, if not more, that his trainer was there with him than him winning the title. So, I mean, it just furthers the legend of Joe Smith, you know?
You know, you mentioned how Joe Smith, probably his most, I guess, would you call Fonfara or Bernard Hopkins his most high-profile win in his career that really gave him the attention?
So to me, I would say the one where people were like, whoa, who is this guy, is Fonfara. So I would say that that's second. And the one that really put him on the map to say, oh man, like, this is a dangerous dude, is when he knocked Bernard Hopkins out of the ring at the Forum in Los Angeles. It was like, okay, you know, we'll see if he caught lightning in a bottle against Fonfara. Because look, Bernard Hopkins is brilliant. I mean, I've sat and talked with Bernard, and he's always cordial with me, and I've learned a lot from Bernard. But Bernard Hopkins was not going to hire or fight a killer in what he thought was going to be a retirement fight. So he probably didn't even know what Joe Smith was capable of, but he found out. Now, thankfully, you know, he's okay from that. But still, like, Bernard Hopkins is a businessman. You think he would have brought in a young, hungry contender that could punch? He was like, all right, he beat Fonfara. Well, Fonfara could be limited if you think about it in some ways. So he brought Joe Smith in, and then he learned quickly that, you know, Joe Smith was for real.
You mentioned Joe Smith and Artur Beterbiev, right, which would be just a collision course. You know, do you think, because what a lot of people are surprised when I've had conversations with people about Artur Beterbiev, that they're surprised when they hear his age. He hasn't really been on the big scene in the sport of boxing for, you know, several years. It's only within the last few years he kind of found his notoriety. Do you think, especially, you know, like, it affected all fighters during this pandemic, do you think that might affect Beterbiev, especially because he is on the older side in boxing terms?
I don't think so, because Beterbiev's getting better as he's getting older. I mean, you know, I remember watching Beterbiev, you know, probably 6-7 years ago, because Yvonne Michel, his promoter, I think they're still his promoter. They have, especially in the early days of PBC, they did a lot of co-promotions. So a lot of Yvonne Michel fighters were fighting on PBC cards and stuff. So I got to see a lot of the fighters that he has within his stable. Beterbiev was one of them. And you saw progression with Beterbiev, but it was like something in like 2017, 2018, where he really started to kick it into that next gear. And there were a couple fights in, I don't know, I forget the year, like 2015, 2016, where he was doing well, but he wasn't blowing the doors off everybody. And people had that standard because he was wiping out guys, and then he let them hang around a little bit. And then in like 2017, 2018, he started blowing people away again. And it's like, whoa. And it just became this avalanche of new fans because, you know, boxing's on ESPN and stuff. They're like, oh my gosh, like, who's this Beterbiev guy? And, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We've known about him for a long time, but he is getting better as he gets older. It all depends on the mindset and what these guys do, because you're going to notice that guys, you know, especially if they're moving up, who did the work during quarantine and during when COVID was happening, who stayed in shape, who kept themselves prepared and ready to go. Because now, as things are opening up, we're going to get fights a lot more frequent. We're busy. We're headed towards a busy spring and a busy summer.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely a busy time coming up in the sport of boxing. I want to pose this question to Mike before I pose it to you, Ray. Joe, you know, we're talking about Joe Smith Jr. and Artur Beterbiev. You know, what, you know, kind of break it down for me. How would that fight turn out, Mike?
It would be amazing. It would be a great fight. It's going to be in the middle of the ring, and they're just going to be like that little game you get as kids where there's those two boxers just stand in the middle and they just punch each other. That's pretty much what it would be like. I think Beterbiev just maybe too skilled. You know, I think Joe Smith he's got a good story. He looked a little bit limited. I thought the Vlasov fight was probably a little bit closer than I kind of expected it to be. Beterbiev didn't look too good in his last fight when he fought out in Russia. He knocked the guy out, but he kind of looked like he could have taken him out earlier. Maybe he wanted rounds. You know, sometimes that is the case because obviously he'd been off for a while. I think Beterbiev though would be just be too big, too strong, and kind of old man him. You know, in the ring, you know, with his amateur pedigree and you know his professional ranks. But you know, I'm pretty sure it'd be a definitely a fight friendly fight.
What do you think, Ray?
I think it would be just pandemonium. I mean, these guys are going to come out center of the ring, and it's like whoever is able to be the last man standing is going to win that fight. And that's a fight that needs to be held with fans and a lot of them. You know what I mean? Like, hopefully everyone's getting their vaccines and moving forward, you know, whatever the case may be. But that's a fight that needs to be in a great fight town with a sold out crowd, not a seat to be had. And hopefully we're getting to that point because they would produce a classic, however long it's going to last. But man, it would be such fun violence that we would be watching between those two, because neither man wants to take a step back. And then especially, you know, that another man has the same ability to tear your head off with one shot. They're both going to really want to test each other's wills inside that ring. So hopefully that's the fight that we get next from both of them.
Do you think that Beterbiev and Joe Smith Jr. are essentially 1 and 2 respectively in the light heavyweight division?
Yeah. I mean, as of right now, I mean, it all depends on if Canelo wants to jump up there. Like, Canelo's the best pound for pound fighter in the world today. And I don't think that, you know, it's like Canelo and then everybody else. So it's like Canelo needs to have his own like sort of rankings because he's number one by far. So if Canelo goes up to 75, then you got to put Canelo up there in the top three. But yeah, 1 and 2 right now, Beterbiev and Joe Smith.
Do you think, you mentioned Canelo being number one pound for pound at the moment, Ray? Do you think this is the first time? Because we've had this conversation on a couple episodes in the past, especially the last month or two. I feel that Canelo's the first, I guess, non-controversial pick at number one in the pound for pound list, even though it's very subjective. You know, it's very subjective, but he's the first, I guess, universal number one pick since Mayweather. When Mayweather was active, nobody argued that he was number one. And then since then, until Canelo, maybe this last year or so, I feel like Canelo has now taken that universal spot. Am I wrong into how I'm describing that?
100% spot on. You know what? I think how fitting is it? You know, we talk about things coming full circle that Canelo lost to Mayweather in September of 2013. And it was like, okay, you know, he got a lesson, et cetera, et cetera. How's he going to respond from this? I mean, his work speaks for itself. I mean, this dude continues to fight the best of the best. And you know, I know how people, like, I've heard, you know, the rumblings on social media. Oh, well, he's picking his guys, this and that. It's like, listen, you try going up in the weights that he's been able to do and fight the top guys, or even if the guys are maybe not number one, but what if they're number two, number three, but they're still a world champion? What, you're going to look down upon that? How can you do that when he's going up to 75? He fought Kovalev, starched him, wrecked him. It wasn't easy, but he knocked him out. Then he goes to 68, and then he was at 60, fought Golovkin twice. It's like, what more does this guy have to do? I mean, seriously, like, he needs to be without a doubt the number one, and he's getting better. And that's scary. That is scary for the entire sport. I don't remember a Mexican fighter that has his slickness compared to what he demonstrates in the ring. He used to be a come forward fighter, punches and bunches, wear you out, and had that big right hand. He's developing so well using his feints, using his head movements, getting better footwork, getting faster, attacking the body more. It is cerebral what Canelo does every single time he fights.
This is for both of you two. Do you think Canelo's been forgiven by the Hispanic community for dropping the title when he fought Triple G? Because I knew some people at my work, you know, they were kind of like, no, he can't do that. Mexican fighters, don't duck people.
I mean, I would say so. I mean, there's such a buzz now when Canelo fights. It gives me, you know, I think he's starting to make his way to being sort of those Mayweather vibes. Like, you guys remember when Mayweather would fight that the world would stop, and people from all walks of life wanted to see that. Now, I don't think Canelo is there right now, but I think he's on his way to getting to that level. So I think that the fans have forgotten, and with the kind of fighters that he's been up there against and winning world championships in multiple divisions, I think people are like, all right, that was in the past, and now let's see what's to come. And Canelo wants to be active. I mean, that's another thing that I think endears him to fight fans all over the globe, not just Mexican fans.
Yeah, I agree. Obviously, it was he got a lot of criticism for during that time frame for doing that, because, you know, people at the end of the day, it was a thirst to see a fight like that. They wanted to see. I mean, like we mentioned, sometimes there's people who criticize, even now, they criticize Canelo saying, oh, he's not number one. He picks his opponent. He fought, you know, a failing Kovalev, even though Kovalev was a world champ at 175 pounds. There's just some people who just will never cut you the break. And I guess the only way you can come out of that hole, so to speak, is to keep fighting the best and keep creating your legacy. And I think Canelo is doing an excellent job on that. And like Ray said, like, I'm just repeating what Ray said, he's getting better and better, and it's scary. It's scary for the whole sport, especially for the people between 160 and 175 pounds.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And then also a fighter who also fight this weekend, who I believe you've announced quite a few times, Jahron Boots Ennis, yeah, remains undefeated at 27-0, gets a 6-round TKO, KO actually, over Sergey Lipinets. Lipinets was down in rounds 4 and 6, and he got a couple shots in against Ennis. Ennis definitely felt the power, but he obviously responded well and got the W. You know, what'd you think about his performance, and where does he go next?
Unbelievable. I mean, like, I know I've used that word a lot, but I mean, it's the truth. I mean, Ennis looked, I mean, my goodness, he has such amazing skill in that ring, from heavy hands, great hand speed, intelligent boxing. He's got, you know, big power shots. He's accurate with his punches. He is selective with the punch that he uses. He gauges distance well. He uses head movement well. Not only that, but he has flash inside the ring and outside the ring. I like his outfits. He's cocky, yet he's humble. And he is so in tune with who he is as a human being. And he's only 23 years old. That's the thing. This guy is only going to get better, and I can't wait to see what's next for him. What do I want to see next for him? Look, Sean Porter and him, I think, would be unreal. Him and your Dennis Ugas, that's fine with me too. Him, Jamal James, I'm good with that too. I mean, you know, line him up. I mean, I think that he is one fight away from fighting the big dogs at 47. Now, from a business standpoint, boxing, he's probably 2 or 3 fights away. But from what I'm seeing in terms of natural ability and the package in which presented to me right now, as you asked me here on April 13th, 2021, I think he's ready. One fight, you know, of those guys that I mentioned, like that second tier of champion. So, like, you know, you have the interim champion, the regular champion. He's ready for that second tier of guys, or those number one contenders, you know, the Sean Porters of the world. I think he's ready for that level. And then, you know, depending on what happens with Spence, Crawford, Pacquiao, then line him up. If he's successful with his next fight, line him up for those guys. That's where I think Ennis is right now.
Somebody who just recently fought, who's been, I guess, in type of a parallel conversation with Boots Ennis, is Virgil Ortiz Jr. He just fought and gained the most significant win of his career, of his young career, against Maurice Hooker. At this point, how they're both progressing, they're obviously both progressing in an excellent manner. They're doing really, really well. They're, you know, impressing everybody who's watching them. When do you see, could you ever see them down the line fight each other in a mega fight? And, you know, as of right now, even if they fought, let's just say next month, who would you favor?
I mean, I'd favor Ennis by a lot. And that, here's the thing, that's no knock on Virgil Ortiz, because I think Virgil Ortiz is super talented. I think he has such a fan-friendly style. I think that he's resonating with the fans, especially in his hometown of Fort Worth. And that Dallas area is buzzing. Man, is it hot down there for boxing talent. I mean, Texas is really making some major waves in boxing. But I favor Ennis because I think Ennis is more the complete fighter. Against Virgil Ortiz, I think that Virgil, I mean, it was mightily impressive that he finished off Hooker in the sixth round, if I'm correct, right? Didn't he finish him off in like the sixth, or was it later than that?
I believe it was the sixth, right, Mike?
No, yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, I think it was the sixth.
So it's sixth round. So my whole thing is that I pay attention to, like, I really want to pick apart a performance. I think Ortiz got hit a little bit too much against Maurice Hooker. And there's no knock on Virgil Ortiz because Maurice Hooker is a bad dude. Former world champion at 140, aggressive style, comes in shape. But I think Ortiz got hit a little bit too much. When if you look at it, it was a similar opponent, maybe a little bit more durable than Lipinets, but Lipinets was also aggressive, comes forward, athletic, likes to throw punches and bunches. And it's got tagged, but not to the caliber that Virgil Ortiz got tagged. And then I think that Ennis also has a higher ring IQ. But again, I'm just comparing. It's like I'm comparing 1A to 1B. So I want to let your listeners know and your viewers know, I'm not like saying Ortiz is bad at all. I'm just saying like this is the level that we're talking about, like that 1% air, that rarefied air at 147. So I think Ennis moves his head better. I think he's faster. And I think he is he uses his distance better than that of Ortiz. But you know what? Over the next, you know, year or two, Ortiz can improve even that much more. Either way, sign me up. If that fight could happen tomorrow or next month, I think it'd be one of the best fights that we'll see in boxing right now. Like right now, and they're only going to get better. Can you imagine 2 years from now? Oh, my gosh.
Right. Absolutely. Another welterweight who actually fought this past weekend, too, was across the pond in Mike's native land. Conor Benn also remained undefeated, improving to 18-0 in his first round stoppage over Sammy Vargas for the WBA Continental welterweight title. I think Conor Benn and Mike's a little bit more familiar with Conor Benn as a UK fighter, but they've mentioned Conor Benn's name around Ennis because, you know, Ennis obviously fought this past weekend. So, you know, both young fighters kind of fighting up the ranks and trying to find their way into the thick of that competition in the Porters and the Garcias and the Spence and the Pacquiao. Before I ask your opinion on a Conor Benn, Ray, Mike, I want to ask you what you thought about this fight and his first round stoppage over Vargas.
You know, obviously just on paper is an amazing stoppage. You know, Samuel Vargas has been in there with a lot of big names, come up second in all of those fights. But, you know, against Virgil Ortiz, Errol Spence, Amir Khan, they all went rounds with him. Whereas Conor Benn got him out there in, I think it was like 82 seconds, which kind of shows, you know, as soon as he kind of, you know, caught him, you could see Vargas kind of stumbled. Conor Benn just jumped on him and that was it. Had him up against the ropes. You know, he was kind of taking those shots where his head was kind of flying back. And I thought the referee did the right thing and, you know, pulled him out of there. I still think he's a little bit raw around the edges. You know, Sean Porter was another name that everybody seems to get linked to in the welterweight division. I think that's kind of a step too far. I think because of the Benn last name and a couple of recent victories, I think then either pushing him up a little bit too quickly. I don't think he's up there with you, Sean Porters, and those guys in the topper parts of the welterweight division. You know, putting him in there with maybe like an Amir Khan, Kell Brook, someone that has that name recognition but is coming down the hill rather than going up the hill. But in the same instance, what does that bring to the table for Amir Khan and Kell Brook? You know, when they can fight each other for probably a bigger purse, they're not fighting some, you know, young, hungry lion. So it's kind of, what does he bring to the table for them apart from probably a good ass kicking? So I don't think they'll take it.
I wouldn't mind seeing him fight a guy by the name of Sebastian Formello who fought Sean Porter. And I mean, Formello's a young kid, you know, learned a lot in that fight against Sean Porter. He didn't win a round, but you know what? Formello's a kid who's was undefeated at the time. And, you know, hey, look, he's young, he's hungry. He's coming off of the loss at the end of Porter. Put him in there with Conor Benn and see if Formello can, and even though Formello doesn't have punching power, but still, you know, Formello was proved to be durable against Sean Porter. What would Conor Benn do to him or how would the fight play out? I think that'd be an interesting matchup, especially at this level of where Conor Benn is in his career.
He fought him last fight.
Oh, you did?
You did, yeah. No, you fought him. Yeah, you fought him
last fight. Sorry about that. I'm, you know, I lose. My bad.
Good shout, though. The matchmakers thought the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, like, it's like thinking, you know, it's hard for me to follow everything, guys. Let me put it out there like that. So,
absolutely, absolutely. Now, we'll give you a pass for that. I'm sure our listeners will give you a pass for that. It's not a big deal. Also on that card from the Copper Box Arena in London, this was on the DAZN card. Savannah Marshall proves a 10-0 with third round knockout over Maria Lindberg. Marshall retains her WBO middleweight title. Marshall's name is being thrown around with Clarissa Shields. You know, that's the fight that people want to see. They're talking about. Clarissa's obviously hasn't been shy about posting on social media and in interviews that she wants to get paid by Eddie Hearn. It's not that she's shying away from Marshall. You know, if you were able to catch the highlights or catch this fight, what'd you think about Marshall's third round knockout performance? And what's the perspectives of going forward about a Clarissa Shields fight, in your opinion?
I thought Marshall looked really good. I think she did what she had to do because, I mean, you know, her and Clarissa Shields going back and forth, and Eddie believes a lot in his fighters, which he has every right to because of what him and, you know, his entire group have been able to do. I mean, look, they put their fighters in great positions to excel. And then if they win or lose, then they go from there. So I want to see a Shields Marshall fight, but one fight here, one fight in the UK. I'll let them hash it out as to, you know, what location is first. But I think that fight needs to happen. And also Clarissa Shields, you know, she's doing MMA. She's doing MMA, I think June 10th, if I'm correct, somewhere around there, you know, with PFL. So, you know, she's starting to split her time, but I still would love to see that her fight against Savannah Marshall. And, you know, let's see it, you know, let's see the two fight deal happen. And, you know, if they have to do the first fight in the UK, I think Clarissa Shields has no problem going over there for the first fight.
At this moment, who do you think is the favorite in between that matchup, right? Because I think earlier in their amateur career, and I forgot exactly when, but I think Marshall has a win over Clarissa Shields. So that obviously adds to the potential narrative of a potential fight that could add to the marketing campaign of everything. But at this point, now that they've been professionals for quite a while, who do you think is a logical favorite?
I think a slight favorite goes to Clarissa Shields based on what I saw in her last fight against, Eve Marie Dicar, because I'm starting to see more athleticism out of Clarissa Shields. She is, I know she didn't get the knockdown, but she staggered Dicar a few times, but I'm starting to see some MMA-like tendencies because she's sitting down in her shots more. She's more explosive. She's more athletic. And that comes from, you know, training for wrestling and doing the whole, you know, part of combat sports, you know, the wrestling, the jiu-jitsu, all that stuff, you know, the kickboxing that she's working on with Mike Winklejohn and Greg Jackson down there in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And, you know, they do a wonderful job with their fighters from an MMA standpoint. And you saw explosiveness out of Clarissa Shields based on the angles, based on the pop behind her punches in the fight back last month on pay-per-view. So I would give the slight edge to Clarissa Shields based on athleticism. And also, I think Shields is mightily brilliant inside that ring. And she has that chip on her shoulder because she lost to her in the amateurs.
So I agree with you, Mike. I give the slight edge to Clarissa Shields as well. But Mike actually gives the edge to Savannah Marshall. And I want Mike to tell you why he believes that.
I think she's an all-around better boxer. I think her shot selection's better. She's heavier-handed. I think if you put on a video split screen of both of them fighting, I think side by side, you would point at Savannah Marshall and say that she's an all-around better boxer. She's slicker, moves up and down a lot better. I think at times, Clarissa just kind of relies on the fact that she's bigger and stronger than a lot of her opponents. She doesn't have that pop where Savannah Marshall, you know, she hasn't exactly fought a lot of people with winning records, but I think she's like 10 victories, 8 KOs, which is unheard of in women's boxing. I think the only thing that she might have against her is she's doesn't seem overly confident at times. So I don't know whether Clarissa Shields could get into her head, play the mind games, and which could go against her because she seems quite timid, quite quiet person. But when she steps through the ropes, you know, she doesn't. And they also have a professional opponent that they've both fought in Hannah Rankin, who went to a decision with Shields, and Savannah Marshall knocked her out.
I mean, I think styles make fights. So it all depends on when the fight is, where it is. And then, you know, you can start to factor in those intangibles as to who the favorite should be. But, you know, like I said, I give a slight favorite to Shields, but in my opinion, odds maker wise, it better be a pick'em fight when it's announced there, if that fight happens. If not, you're going to get a slight edge. It's going to be like something so small, like maybe minus 115 or something that, you know, slim when it comes to how the odds makers have this fight handicapped.
Also on that card, another female fight, Shannon Courtney gets the 10-round unanimous decision win over Ebony Bridges. Courtney becomes the vacant WBA bantamweight world champion. This was a very entertaining fight. Bridges, you can see just by looking, if you didn't watch the fight, you just look at Bridges' eye, how it was closed, that just makes you want to see, like, oh, I need to watch this fight now. Mm-hmm. Were you able to watch this fight or catch the highlights, right? And if you did, what'd you think?
Man, they went at it. It was a fun fight to watch, and I hope we see more of those fights. I mean, not necessarily back to back from those two fighters, because that's not healthy either, but I mean, they brought it. They brought it, and people were talking about them. And, you know, even in a loss with Bridges, I think people want to see her fight next and who she's going to fight next. And with Courtney, she had a loss early in her career, and, you know, she came back and put on a performance like that. So I think it just goes to show that just because you lose in boxing, that's part of combat sports. Not everyone's going to be Floyd. Not everybody's going to be undefeated, and everyone's trying to protect that goose egg and stuff like that. I like gambles like this, and I think both fighters come on a lot more popular because of that fight and them mixing it up compared to if they would have won a boring decision either way.
So you mentioned, Ray, how, you know, how Bridges, obviously she took the loss this past weekend, but even though she took the loss, she came out of it
better
than she was, I guess.
Massively.
Absolutely. Yeah. Ray, in your experience and how many fights that you've called over the years up until this point, and obviously you're going to call more going forward, because you do call most of the events from beginning to end, from like 2 o'clock in the afternoon to 10 o'clock at night, you're there pretty much the whole time. So you see all the fights, whereas some people just watch like the last two or three main events, co-feature and stuff like that.
Yeah.
How many times of your career have you seen maybe a fight of this, you know, similarity where the losing boxer comes out of it better than they were before the fight?
No, I mean, I've seen it many times. I mean, even when Lipinets lost to Mikey Garcia, right? And he lost in San Antonio, and it was like, oh, you know, he lost his world title, you know, he should be sad and this and that. Yeah, he was sad, and he, you know, it wasn't fun for him, but he put on a really a good performance. It's not like he was totally outclassed and this and that. I mean, he went out and, you know, he gave his best. He just lost to the better man that night. I mean, if we had the mentality of protecting the goose egg and being so overly cautious, we would have never had Arturo Gatti. We would have never had Mickey Ward. Barrera lost to Kennedy McKinney, if we remember that, guys. I mean, Morales, I mean, we would have never had these legends that we have seen in boxing. It has to change. And being undefeated is special. And I give them all the credit in the world for those that do. But just because you lose doesn't mean you're finished. That's why when people talk about Deontay Wilder, oh, he got starched by Tyson Fury, this and that. It's like, yeah, I mean, he lost and Fury was the better man that night. But to say he's finished is ludicrous, because I can go down the list of fighters that have come back after devastating losses. And, oh, how's he going to recover? Canelo did pretty good after losing to Floyd Mayweather. You know, Golovkin has done pretty good even after losing to Canelo. I mean, why is there this unfair expectations that you have to be undefeated? I mean, I think it's ridiculous.
Looking at the fight, you can, for any up-and-coming boxer, male, female, they need to look at what Ebony Bridges did. Literally, what, like a year ago, she was 2-0, 3-0 in Australia. Nobody knew who she was. That just shows you the power of social media, that she managed to get the attention of Matchroom. She managed to get the attention of Eddie Hearn. Just using social media, she talked her way into a WBA bantamweight, you know, world title fight off the back of just being very, very PR savvy. you know, and people need to understand that that's part of the game. You need to be a good self-promoter. You know, she just used what she had, you know, anyone coming through, you just think of a gimmick, you know, if you're funny, you know, if you just want to do crazy things, you know, that all sells. And look at what she's done. You know, she went into the fight, came out second best, but gave a really, really good account of herself. And Matchroom guarantee will use her again.
Well, Mike, even to piggyback off your point, I mean, everything that you just said about Bridges, I mean, look what Jake Paul's been able to do.
Right.
I mean, he's 2-0 and he's headlining his first pay-per-view. And the thing is Jake Paul, he goes, man, he's even said on his social media, he's like, you know, I'm 2-0 headlining my pay-per-view. He goes, he knows what it is to make and create a reaction either for the better or for the worse. Plus, he's training with some quality guys, BJ Flores, J. Leon Love, guys have been around the sport their entire lives. He's with good people. Everything that I hear from training camp down there with Anthony Durrell and stuff that, you know, I called Durrell's fight when he had the draw against, Kyron Davis. And, you know, he said, he goes, hey, man, you know, this kid can really pop. And he's, you know, growing and he's only 24 years old. He's got a wrestling background and he's making people pay, or, you know, he's getting people to get so amped up about his fight that you're going to pay to watch him either win or lose. I mean, he's only 2-0. Can you imagine if other younger fighters thought with that same type of marketing strategy to be like, even though I'm 3-0, I'm going to market myself and I'm going to really push my fight instead of just being like, I'm going to show up, I'm going to fight, and then everything else will do the talking. Well, yeah, you got to handle business in the ring, but there's also another big part of what it is to be a prize fighter. The key word is prize fighter. You're fighting for a prize. The more money that you can generate, the more people, the eyeballs that you can generate, the more money in your pockets for you and your family. Fight for a prize and do that extra little bit of work because it'll pay off tenfold.
Like you just touched on earlier in the interview, Conor McGregor, Floyd Mayweather. You were saying how hardworking they were. They understand the business, and that's why they are where they are.
Exactly. I mean, and again, all it is work ethic. They're not, you know, you're not being asked to, you know, perform brain surgery. It's just like, hey, like maybe if you want to shut down interviews the week of the fight, I understand. But over the course of training camp, when, you know, people want to be interviewed or whatever, like, do as much as you can to get your name out there. If there's a fighter that you want to compete against, talk about it. Let the people know, because, you know, promotion, you know, podcasts like you will talk about it on social media. And then that's how the ball gets rolling. How did Mayweather McGregor start to become a thing? Because of the fact that Conor, I think, called him out, or Floyd said, you know, if there's one guy would come out for, it would be Conor McGregor. And Conor was like, wait a minute. Okay, here we go. And it just, and look at it. Like, are you kidding me? Just by words.
So a fighter who's actually fighting this weekend on the 17th, the Saturday, from the Seminole Hard Rock and Casino in Hollywood, Florida, on DAZN, mm-hmm. defending his WBO middleweight world title is Demetrius Andre, 29-0, as he goes up against Liam Williams. Before I get your opinion on that matchup this weekend, Ray, Demetrius Andre, even though he has the world title at 160 pounds, where, you know, you have a Canelo, you have a Triple G, you have a Charlo. He seems like he's the odd man out, that, you know, he can't land one of these big names like a Canelo, a Triple G, a Charlo. We talked about fighters marketing themselves like an Emmett Bridges, or, you know, putting Conor McGregor, Mayweather, kind of putting yourself out there. What does Andre have to do to get that type of attention?
I mean, he's starting to talk more. He's starting to get out there more and stuff, but it's a process, right? So, you know, you've seen it over the past, you know, 9 months to 12 months out of him, but I don't think he was always like that. I mean, he was kind of more quiet, more subdued. You're starting to see more personality out of him. And I think he's with a quality promoter, you know, Eddie Hearn, Matchroom Boxing. They're going to put him in positions to succeed. He just has to go out and handle business. And now he understands that he has to be at these fights. And I think after Canelo beat Callum Smith, you know, he was there, or it was at Yildirim or Smith, maybe both. He probably went to both.
I think it was
and
both.
He had him on. Yeah. And he was, you know, ripping, you know, Canelo and stuff like that. Now he's starting to do it. But if he would have been able to do it 2 years ago, maybe he would have gotten a fight with Canelo and been able to upset Canelo enough, and there would have been enough interest to be able to generate that fight. it still could happen because of where Andrade is. And, you know, he's with Eddie, and I think Eddie's brilliant at, you know, what he does as a promoter and stuff like that. So I just think it takes a little bit of time for people to be like, wait a minute, like, where did this come from out of you? You know, now you're being bombastic and calling guys out. So give the public a little bit of time to grasp this new Demetrius Andrade. And I think Andrade will get a big fight soon.
And what do you think about his matchup this weekend against Liam Williams?
I mean, I haven't, honestly, guys, I feel bad, but I haven't looked at that fight because of, you know, my obligations. But
right.
Listen, Andrade is stylistically so tough to deal with. I mean, I remember he was co-promoted by Joe DiGuardia and Artie Palullo. So I remember working for Artie, and Artie, you know, had him around and stuff like that. This dude is smart. He uses his distance well. He's got a slick jab. I mean, he can, you know, box your ears off 9 times out of 10. And I think he fought Willie. I called a fight in 2015 when Provodnikov lost to John Molina Jr. And he beat Willie Nelson. And Willie Nelson, if you guys remember, was a guy that beat Tony Harrison. Very tough, very tall, has power. And Andrade made, you know, I think he stopped Willie Nelson. And Willie Nelson was like the epitome of a gatekeeper, right? And, you know, Andrade just did what he wanted with him. So I was like, man, like, this is an aggressive Demetrius Andrade now. So Andrade just stylistically is tough to deal with.
Mike, what do you think? You think Liam Williams is has a better shot than people think?
I think he's probably better than a lot of the American fans believe. But like, you know, Ray just touched on, I think Demetrius Andrade is definitely the slicker, more skillful boxer. I think the only chance that Liam Williams really have is to catch him. It really is just to catch him. Apart from that, I think we'll see the usual. Andrade just kind of, you know, sweeps home on points. You know, Williams has a decent chin since, you know, moving up in weight and changing gym to Dominic Ingle. He seems to have found his knockout power. If he catches him, I could see Liam Williams taking it. But if you told me to put a bet on, I would probably go with Andrade probably sweeping him on points.
Right. Yeah, that seems like the safe bet. And as we round the corner here towards the finish line on this week's episode of The Last Round, just like we touched on a little bit earlier, Jake Paul returns back to a boxing ring from the Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Atlanta, Georgia, on Triller and also on Fight TV pay-per-view, as he goes up against the MMA world's Ben Askren, who's making his boxing debut. You know, what do you think about this matchup, Ray? And in addition to that question, now that we're kind of on the fast track here with Triller in this boxing world, and kind of putting on these types of fights, I wouldn't even call them fights, they're entertainment events. Mm-hmm. They're sports and entertainment events.
Yep.
What do you think about the matchup? And then what do you think about Triller and their plan as a whole?
Well, first of all, guys, I am so excited and I'm honored to be a part of Triller Fight Club. I believe, like, you know, Peter Kahn is the, you know, the director of boxing for Triller Fight Club, and you're not going to find a nicer and more down-to-earth and passionate person, a part of boxing, than what Peter Kahn is. I think the entire team that they've assembled, Snoop Dogg with his passion for boxing and combat sports and everything he brings to the table. This is a movement that is happening with Triller because I want everyone in boxing to do well. And I think that they feel the same way. But this is a little bit of an alternative to what you're typically accustomed to. And not to say that there's anything wrong with that. You know, I like all forms of how boxing is presented. Every network I watch or that I work with has a different look and a different style. And that's great. That's important for the business. Triller is the same way. You're going to see boxing shot in a different way. You're going to get top level entertainment acts. I mean, Justin Bieber, are you kidding me? Like, this guy will sell out 100,000 seat places with non-COVID world, you know, in 20 minutes. And here he's performing, you know, Doja Cat, Major Lazer. I mean, you know, the list goes, the Black Keys. It's unreal at the level of entertainment. And then on top of that, you know, you have Jake Paul, kids who's 2-0, who's really looking to make a statement. And I know that people are like, oh, why is he fighting Ben Askren? I do fights all over the country and have for a long time. And I'll tell you that even if you're a 5 or 6-0 prospect, I can't tell you how many times we call in a fight, and in the bio sheet or in the fighter meetings, we learn that the opponent that the 5 or 6-0 fighter is competing against, even though he has a record of a boxing record that's like lopsided, meaning like he might be 3-6 or 3-7, he's a former MMA fighter. He also is an MMA fighter. Okay, so let's look at Ben Askren, former MMA fighter, making his pro boxing debut, Bellator champion, top 5 UFC contender. Jake Paul is only 2-0. Like, hello, like, it's not like he's 10 or 12-0. He's not saying he's Vasily Lomachenko ready to fight for the world title. He's like, okay, you know, I went ahead, beat Nate Robinson, I beat a YouTuber before. Now I'm fighting a real fighter. Okay, after that, then we'll see what's next for Jake Paul. But Ben Askren is no easy task, because Ben Askren has succeeded in every form of combat sports that he's excelled at. Now, will he be able to do that in boxing? We'll find out Saturday night on pay-per-view.
You know, as a boxing fan, probably the fight I'm looking forward to in terms of competitiveness and you know, technique and all that is Regis Prograe and Ivan Redkach. That's the fight I'm definitely looking forward to this weekend. What do you think about that matchup, Ray?
Fun fight. I mean, man, I know both guys very well. I mean, I remember when Regis Prograe fought Julius Ndongo, and I was ring announcing on Showbox at the Deadwood Mountain Grand in South Dakota. Or we were in South Dakota. We went to Mount Rushmore, you know, the morning of the fight. So I remember Prograe from back then. He has a great trainer, Bobby Benton, and, you know, Aaron Navarro as well. You know, Ivan Redkach looked tough, durable. You know, the guy's going to come in shape. He's going to come forward. You know, he comes from the Ukraine, so that Ukrainian school of boxing, took Danny Garcia the distance in January of 2020. 6 months before that, beat Devin Alexander when Alexander was on his comeback, and Redkach beat him, finished him off, I think, 4th, 5th round. So you can't ever discount Ivan Redkach. And for Regis Prograe, 32 years of age, former super lightweight champion of the world, and now he's being exposed to a new audience. So not just the hardcores or fight fans, you're being exposed to people that are just Jake Paul fans or that are just Justin Bieber fans. And Regis Prograe can make a statement. Either one of them can make a statement to get some of those fans and the general population to start following their boxing career. So this is big for both men.
Mike, what do you think about the matchup?
Regis Prograe, I think, should take it. You know, I know he's had a little bit of time out the ring. I think he was kind of hoping that he could jump onto a bigger fight, you know, because after that great fight he had with Josh Taylor, like we touched on earlier, like even though he lost, he came out of that fight with an even more enhanced resume. I think he was kind of scratching around, hoping he could talk himself into an Adrian Broner fight. That didn't obviously come to fruition. So, you know, he's now in there with Ivan Redkach. But Ivan Redkach is always in a good fight. So, you know, I think this should be really, really good. Is it at 140, 147?
I think it's 140 to my knowledge. I mean, I could be wrong, but at 140. And Prograe is coming off of the win over Juan Araldez. If you remember, Araldez was undefeated on Halloween night, and Prograe went out there and just blasted him. I mean, he literally punched holes right through Araldez. And Araldez is the same guy that beat Jose Miguel Borrego, who Borrego was like 19 or 20 years old. And he was like 14-0 with like 12 knockouts. That was on the undercard of Mayweather McGregor. But so it's like, I use the process of elimination that, you know what, you know, Prograe's win over Araldez, people are like, oh, ho-hum. It's like, no, like Araldez is a very talented fighter, and Prograe just obliterated him.
Right.
He's good to watch, and he's a good interview as well. So he kind of knows the business. I did wonder, because I know he was talking about going up to 147, because, you know, him and Mo Hooker were supposed to fight, but they couldn't. One of them wanted it at like 144 pounds, and I think Prograe was saying, no, I want it at 143, and the fight ended up getting scrapped. So I was wondering what weight it was going to be at.
Yeah, and then the pandemic hit, so it was even, you know,
right.
It was rough.
Do it at 154.
maybe. Also on that card, Steve Cunningham returns and goes up against also another MMA legend, and Frank Mir, what a lot of our boxing fans might know, maybe if they're casual MMA fans. Frank Mir gave Brock Lesnar the first MMA loss of his career, so that's why a lot of people might recognize the name. What do you think about in general, Ray, of these, you know, these boxing and MMA fighters kind of going at it in with boxing gloves?
I don't mind it because it's entertainment. You know, Steve Cunningham is not, I mean, Steve Cunningham is just former world champion. I think, you know, aside from Deontay Wilder, the only guy to put down Tyson Fury in the course of his career. So, I mean, Steve Cunningham's the real deal. But again, Cunningham's not saying, hey guys, I'm coming back to be, you know, world champion, this and that. He's like, all right, I'm going to come back, see where I'm at, you know, take this opportunity against Frank Mir. Frank Mir, same way. Frank Mir, former UFC heavyweight champion in the world. He's fought some big poppers in, you know, the octagon. And I know boxing's different, but also Frank Mir is going to have a 40 to 50 pound weight advantage in his favor. So anything can happen. I mean, the thing is that be ready for anything on Saturday night. All I'm going to tell you is for 4 hours nonstop, you know, like when you're watching any event, a football game, a basketball game, you have a few minutes to go to the bathroom or, you know, get your drink of choice or get your food, whatever. For the 4 hours that we're on the air on Saturday night from 9 o'clock in the evening Eastern time to 1 in the morning, it's going to be nonstop action and entertainment. If it's not action inside the ring, it's going to be entertainment on the stage or even across of both. So just be ready for anything, guys. It is going to be a wicked show on Saturday night. It's a hybrid of like boxing with entertainment to all these different celebrities around and stuff like that. I mean, I can't wait. And I think the audience is only going to benefit from that.
I feel for you, Ray. You have a terrible job.
Man, I can't wait, guys. I'm pumped to get down to Atlanta.
She'd probably call in sick that day.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Ray, what was your reaction? Because when Triller's an infant on the scene, but they, you know, they kind of already, they're trying to make a big splash, especially in the boxing world. But what was your reaction when Ryan Kavanaugh showed up at the Lopez Cambosis purse bid, kind of out of nowhere, and just outbid everybody who was there, Top Rank, Eddie Hearn? Because I guess before that point, a lot of people thought, oh, Triller's kind of in it more for the entertainment aspect. Yeah. You know, they're going to do YouTube fighters and stuff. Uh-huh. And then Ryan Kavanaugh comes in and bids over $6 million for that fight and kind of pretty much shows the boxing world and tells the boxing world, hey, we're in the boxing business. We're going to put on some good fights. What was your reaction when you first heard that news?
Talk about the surprise of the century, because nobody could have predicted that. And when he comes out and I read it was like over $6 million, I'm like, whoa, like, and what I like about that is Ryan Kavanaugh of Triller wanted to make a statement. He's like, this is the guy, this is the fight, and I'm going to win this. And I'm going to prove to everybody that we are a bona fide player. And boy, oh boy, did he do that with that resounding offer. And I love it. I mean, I don't know if you guys, I mean, occasionally I'll watch, but like, you know, with the WWE, the Money in the Bank briefcase, and they come in and cash in for the world title. That's what Ryan Kavanaugh did, was like, wait a minute, I got an envelope, I got the briefcase, and everyone's like, wait a minute, what? Like, what's going on? And man, I think it's great for the sport because it raises everybody's level that much more. I love the fact that there are so many different promotions and networks invested in boxing, because if one network isn't on their A game, then the other one has to raise their level and everything else. Like, everyone has to be at their best, because if you're not, the fight fans are like, okay, we can go to this network, we can go to this promotion, we're going to follow that and support that because they're not bringing their best. That's what I love about this. Boxing is in such a healthy place right now, and it's only getting better.
Ray, without giving too much away, have they kind of told you, because obviously you're signed with Triller, you know, how many events we may see this year?
So all I know is what has been announced is that we got this one on Saturday night on pay-per-view. Then we go June 5th with, you know, Teofimo Lopez and George Kambosos. And I learned while watching the press conference with you guys, when De La Hoya went up, whatever, I'm like, oh, guess I'm working July 3rd now. You know what I mean? Like, okay, cool. Like, spending July 3rd calling an Oscar De La Hoya fight, I think I'm going to be enjoying my 4th of July weekend pretty well there and stuff. So, I mean, I know that we're doing 3 fights over the next few months and stuff. And guys, it can't come soon enough, because I'm telling you, the production level behind this is going to be something that you've never seen before when it comes to boxing.
Ray, did you ever think in your wildest dreams you would be calling Oscar De La Hoya and Evander Holyfield?
Never, but you know what? It's like, man, I mean, again, things come full circle. I watched Holyfield growing up and remember him and his epic fights with Riddick Bowe. And I mean, Oscar De La Hoya was such a part of HBO boxing. And I think one of the greatest sequences of all time was when Jim Lampley was calling when De La Hoya had Fernando Vargas hurt. And over the course of those 30 to 45 seconds, Lampley was absolutely masterful. And I think he ended it with, he could get the most satisfying moment of his career if he stops Fernando Vargas. Pause, Cortez or whoever the referee is stops it. He did it. Oscar De La Hoya, his most satisfying victory. That is like some stuff that my head exploded. Like how my head is on my shoulders after listening to that. That is masterful stuff. Like you will never, that's like Michael Jordan in the air against Magic Johnson and doing like that as he's gliding the air and doing it upside down and hitting the layup. Like that's how good that moment was in boxing. So I'm pumped to be able to call a De La Hoya and a Holyfield fight.
We appreciate your time. Ray, we know you're a busy guy, especially the next 3 months. They definitely got you booked up. So we definitely appreciate you making time for us here at the Last Round. Before we let you go ahead and plug your social media. Obviously you got Triller Fight Club this Saturday, everything you got upcoming, go ahead. The floor is yours.
Oh, I appreciate it, guys. So I got, MLW, depending when this airs, MLW every single Wednesday on YouTube, BN Sports. So check that out. 7 Eastern every single Wednesday, Saturday, Triller Fight Club, pay-per-view, Jake Paul, Ben Askren, Justin Bieber. It's going to be unbelievable. A wonderful star-studded cast that are on the show there. Tuesday, I'll be calling PBC on FS1 in Los Angeles. Not familiar on the time on that one, guys. Pumped about that. The PBC staff do a wonderful job, TGB Promotions. And then next Friday, I will be calling the Jaime Munguia, Demetrius Ballard fight on DAZN alongside my good friend, Sergio Moro. So that'll be next Friday. So Saturday, Wednesday's MLW, Saturday, Triller Fight Club, Tuesday, FS1, and then Friday, next Friday on DAZN, calling Jaime Munguia, Demetrius Ballard. Looking forward to seeing one of the best middleweights in the world in Munguia perform and get inside the ring. And then social media-wise, SBR Flores. So SBR Flores on social media. I'm going to take you guys behind the scenes at the weigh-ins, during the press conference, during fight night. I'm going to go behind the scenes. So check out my Instagram, my Facebook story. Check it out, SBR Flores, all weekend long. And, thank you guys, the fight fans, and thank you guys for doing an amazing job covering the sport. We definitely need, more passionate media members to be a part of the sport and spread the word. Without you guys, we wouldn't be able to have the platform that we're on.
Definitely appreciate the kind words, Ray. And as we sign off here, Mike, go ahead, the usual, let our fans and listeners know where they can follow us.
And we're at The Last Round 12 on Instagram and Twitter. And obviously join us next week. We'll be reviewing the Jake Paul and Ben Askren card. And then looking forward to the Edward Belanger, Damon Nicholson. And we also have Emmanuel Navarrete up against Christopher Diaz.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So for our guest of the week and commentator, announcer, jack of all trades, essentially, and Ray Flores. We appreciate you once again for coming on. For my co-host, Michael Shepard, I'm Danny Z. This is The Last Round.
Thanks for supporting and listening to the show. Follow us at The Last Round 12 on social media. Rate, review, and subscribe. This is The Last Round Podcast.